Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome, welcome. If you are tuning in from the 60 plus countries who are listening, or if you are tuning in from a new country, I want to welcome you. I'm Talia Toha. This is the Good Grow Great podcast, and this particular segment is 6 degrees of greatness. And this is where we sit down with 1, 2, 3 different people, and we learn from just the vast variety of backgrounds where they come from. Now, they all kind of have different specific skill sets, different industries, domain spaces, and also different life experiences. So this is really an enriching experience for everyone who are listening. And if you are wondering, how can I, you know, start with a bang if you're just starting out? What are some of the mindsets to do this? But also, if you're kind of a little bit hitting a brick wall and you're hitting a plateau and you're wondering if it's even worth it, right? Or what it really takes to finish, this is the episode for you, because today we're sitting down with Giselle Anderson, and Giselle's work and her life really, Dana Point, where Giselle had ran and operated her whale and dolphin watching safari, which is so cool to begin with, had been featured on LA Times and Trip Advisor's 2020 Traveler's Choice. Today, Giselle's sitting down with us and talking about how they found the one thing that no one else had ever done and how that helped them stand out from the very get-go. And also, she's sharing with us really the transformative power of not taking no for an answer, right? So if you have just gotten a no, or worst, being ghosted, or just crickets, right? This is going to be interesting. Today, she's also going to be sharing what she learned during 6 straight months of pure difficulties and obstacles in her business with Dave, and how you can also apply some of the key elements that got them out of that darkness. And so you can kind of tune into that and apply it to whatever it is that you're doing as well. Now, we're also going to be sitting down with Shawnee Harley. And Shawnee, after being a 2-time Olympic assistant coach with the Canada basketball team, Shawnee dedicates her life to coach athletes, parents, or anyone to succeed in the podium of life, as she would put it. Born in Alaska, Harley had spent summers living on a commercial fish boat to make extra money. And there she learned grit, perseverance, and independence at a very young age. Today, she's sharing with us how she helps people unlock their superpower, even if they think that they don't have any. And she's also sharing with us the hidden difference between confidence and competence. Really interesting, right? Confidence and competence. And also what we didn't know about playing to win versus the fear of losing, and the difference between the two, and how this can actually supercharge your purpose and in many ways your profit as well. So sit down with us, grab that delicious cup of coffee or something refreshing to drink while you listen to this, or just water if you're going out running and walking, exercising, or running an errand. But before we get started, be sure to hit follow, subscribe, add, or collect, and let's dive in. All right, welcome to the podcast, Shawnee and Giselle. I'm so excited to hear both of your stories, but I actually wanted to start with Giselle. And you have this fantastic business, Captain Dave's, and whale watching, dolphin watching, the whole lot, which I am just, I mean, every day, whenever I think of you, I'm just kind of like, oh, I wish I could be out there watching, you know, in the sea.
Right.
Yeah. And so, and I'm kind of curious, because you mentioned, you know, before we started rolling, you had mentioned that you actually started this about 20 plus years ago, and with your husband, Dave, in the business, and you actually met him when you were on a sailboat. Is that right? Or you each had your own sailboat?
Right. So we each had our own sailboats, and he from Texas and me from Los Angeles, which is about an hour north of Dana Point, had come to Dana Point Harbor the same month. And through a series of events, we ended up with our boats both at the same dock. And a few months later, someone who knew both of us said, "You guys know each other, right?" Because we had so much in common. And they introduced us. And that was pretty, that was November of 1995. And by New Year's Eve, we knew that we would be together. And we got married. I know we got married a couple of years later. And Dave already had his captain's license and he was taking people out. He was also doing it for friends. And that's part of why we got introduced, because he was taking his friends out every Friday night and I was taking my friends out every Saturday and Sunday, and we would have big groups on our boats. And so, you know, it was kind of clear that we had a similar heart to get people out on the water and get them to see what creation's got out there. It's just stunning.
Yeah.
And as he did more and more trips, he began to realize, wow, I mean, there is so much out there. And whale watching at the time was actually just a seasonal thing. It only happened starting after Thanksgiving, and it would go till about April. And if you wanted to get out on the water and see some of the 450,000 dolphins that live off our coast at any other time, you had to kind of either have your own boat, know someone with a boat, or go out on a fishing boat.
Yeah.
To get out on the water. There were no other companies doing that. So we started doing it, and he started doing it. And I was kind of the organizer, if you will, on the back end. But we loved to both get out there and make it happen. So when that was 95.
Yeah. And when did you, because I know that when people look into starting a business or starting a venture, any venture, really, they go through a certain kind of steps of decision making. And we talk about decision making a lot on this podcast. And I think particularly when you
right.
kind of go into something with your potential partner or whatever, there was there resistance, kind of reservations as to whether this will work? Or was it kind of like an immediate, you know what, we got this?
It's a great question. Yeah, Dave was doing plumbing at the time, and he had come from Texas. He had a plumbing business in Texas, and his whole plan was, I just would love to be able to take people out on the water and make enough money to pay the bills. I was in sales for a business legal law company, law publishing company, and I just loved being out on the water. And when we got married, Dave literally was... He had one ad in the phone book back then, phone books, and yeah. his ad was, you know, for Captain Dave's router business. Mm-hmm. And so it was the same phone number. So his phone would ring and he'd pick answer it. And it would either be the Ritz-Carlton calling to book a private charter, or it could be someone who wanted their drains cleaned. It could be someone wanting their drains cleaned. And he never knew. And so after that had been happening for about, a handful of months, I said to him, why don't you just pack up the plumbing stuff for a month, just for a month, and let's try this. I mean, you know, we're on the younger side. We don't have a lot of overhead. He was living on his boat. I had decided to rent my house out and live on my boat before we got married. So we didn't have a lot of overhead. And then when we got married, we lived on his boat for 6 months until I came home one day with groceries and he wasn't there. And I had to, you know, watch the ice cream melt until he got back. And so we lived on these vessels. We didn't have a lot of overhead. And I said, just try it for a month. And he never went back. So he ended up selling his, you know, business and his equipment. And he was very innovative. Dave is a... he's a big picture guy and he gets great ideas. He's very project focused. So he immediately started to realize, wow, you know, we need film. We need video of what's going on out there, because he would come back and he would tell the slip owners or the slip renters around us, other boaters, oh yeah, I saw a pod of, you know, 1,000 dolphin. And they'd be like, really? I don't see that. When I go out, I saw a whale. I never see a whale. So he started to pull this all together, and he had a gift for finding them.
Yeah.
And he started to pull it all together and made a film. And it took him, you know, a couple of 3 years to make the film, 4 years to make the film, but that won a bunch of awards. And so the longer that he, and the more he invested, you know, in the business through the footage, through photographs, his passion, really, our mutual passion, just continued to pay off. We got really blessed, really blessed. We were in the right place at the right time.
Well, and what I love the most about that story is that he kind of shared that idea with you as a just kind of, you know, let's just try it. It doesn't have to be something successful. Like, it doesn't have to be like a fun 10-year type of, you know, 5-10 year type of thing. But it's, you know, it's just kind of like almost like, I guess, a happenstance almost, but a little bit more strategic, which I absolutely love. And really stemming from what he already loves and what you love as well, which is great. Now, I do want to touch real quickly, though, on that kind of those early years when you and Dave were, you know, the first few years that he was making that film and you're kind of starting to grow this concept, you know, into fruition. Were there, because a lot of entrepreneurs, business owners always talk about their initial years with just kind of course, great memories, but they don't want to go through it again because it's a lot of work, right? Was there a moment that you remembered from those early days when you both, or maybe one of you guys, wanted to kind of call it quits?
We had difficulty, but we both were so passionate about what we were doing, and we were literally seeing the world change. So Dave and I went to Yosemite shortly after we got married. And on the whole drive home, Dave said, I want to do for the dolphins off of Dana Point what John Muir did for Yosemite. I want to bring the attention of the world to Dana Point, because we are on the front row of this massive population of dolphin. It is more dense than anywhere else in the world. And who knew that? Who knew? And he found out, and he was like, how come nobody knows this? And if people know, maybe they'll take more steps to protect those animals. And then as we sort of began to gear up and people came, they loved it. And they were so excited to be able to get out on the water throughout the year and have these encounters. And so we just had, you know, one exciting thing after another happened. Now, that doesn't mean it was all fun and games. You know, we were trying to grow and we were trying to get, you know, a bigger boat. And then there was the whole boat loan thing. And that was, you know, that was challenging. And then we would have landlords. We had three different landlord issues. So as we would grow, landlords would say, wow, they're doing really well. Maybe I'll do that. And so we had three different landlords who attempted to duplicate what we were doing and have us leave the premises. So we were like little orphans, you know, trying to find a place to land that was really ours. And that was a very difficult thing. And the day came when we were told, that's it, you guys are done. There is nowhere else in our harbor for you to operate from, and you're going to go. And that was a very challenging day. I will never forget it as long as I live. I'll never forget the event when it took place. And, you know, you come, and I had to come home and tell Dave. And we are people of faith. So we just got on our knees and we said, okay, if that's the way it's going to be, then so be it. We don't think it's the end. We think that you can make a way. So let's see what happens. And 2 days later, we got a call from the county of Orange saying, you know, we've never allowed another location in Dana Point to do commercial whale watching, but we would like to talk to you. Because by then, Dave had really become known for whale rescue, for conservation. We'd done a lot of different things that were really good for the animals and for the community. And so the county stepped in and they gave us a location that was like a dream come true for us. So we had our own docks. We could grow. We had our own area from which to, you know, welcome visitors with an ocean view. It was like, you couldn't have asked for more. It was such a gift. But I will say that for the 6 months that whole process was happening, it was a nightmare. because people were coming in and saying, no, that shouldn't happen. This is blah, blah, blah. And poor Dave barely slept. You know, his blood pressure went through the roof and oh my goodness. But we made it through. And, you know, here we are over 15 years later. And now Dana Point has received the designation as the dolphin and whale watching capital of the world. We've got the trademark on that. And today is the big day when the World Cetacean Alliance, which is the largest organization for dolphin and whale watching protection and conservation in the world, they've recognized Dana Point as the first whale heritage site here in the Americas, both North and South America. There are now only five locations in the world that are called whale heritage sites. And they're locations that have shown themselves to be responsible, to have excellent dolphin and whale watching, of course, but to also have an eye towards education, conservation, research, protection. A lot of different factors come into play to be selected. It was a year-long process. It was a very arduous application process, but it's really exciting. So it's been this fat, and the really cool thing is that we got to do that with our big competitor here in the harbor, who we were across the table from for a long time. So I think that's another takeaway for people is that, you know, when you have competitors, and every business does, it's really easy to become focused on your situation in opposition with them. But when you can try and step back and say, you know, what would benefit us both? Or all of us, and how can we get on the same side of the table and make that happen? It can really be a phenomenal event, and you start to begin to really appreciate the things about your competitors that, you know, maybe before were a bit of an issue to you. Now you're appreciative of the fact that, you know, it does. And it's very healing on a personal level. And it's very gratifying to begin to see this bigger picture of, you know, maybe it's something that can bless your industry or your location or, you know, your community in some way. And so forming alliances is so much, for me personally, it's so much more fun than being in a competitive arena where you're duking it out.
Well, I want to touch real quick on and circle back on that moment when, well, you mentioned those 6 months or period or however long it was when you and Dave were really just on this roller coaster, right? And his blood pressure went up through the roof.
Yeah.
But I want to kind of simmer on that just for a moment for the audience who's listening, who's perhaps going through something similar.
Sure. Yeah.
And they're thinking, you know what, I don't know what to do. And then, you know, their spouse is trying to be supportive, but they have, of course, they're dealing with all these finances. And obviously, it's nice that you guys are in the business together. And that way, the support is there. You already know exactly what you guys are going through, each of you. But what were, do you remember moments when you and Dave perhaps sat down during that, you know, whatever, 6 months, when you both sat down and perhaps exchanged a conversation or two about what to do? And what were some words? I know this is dating back now, but what were some things that you guys may have shared with each other? You know, like, was it something like, oh, I don't know what we're going to do now, or let's just keep going? What were some of those conversations behind the scenes, Giselle?
So again, you know, we're people of faith, and I found a psalm, you know, which is a part in the Bible that really spoke to the situation, and it just brought me so much peace, incredible peace, because I really felt that in the end, what would happen would be whatever God's will was. And if that meant that we would thrive here, then that would be great. And if it meant that the door would close, and maybe Dave would go on to be a filmmaker, or maybe Dave would go on to be a writer, because he is both, and he has done both. He's since written a book, and he had made the film, and he wanted to do a screenplay. He had a lot of gifts, and I had things that I was passionate about too. So it wasn't like, all oh my gosh, life is over. It's just, okay, we're at a crossroads. I know what I would like to see happen.
Yeah.
But I'm going to trust that there's a, you know, something bigger at work here. And I'm going to do my due diligence. We're going to do everything we can within our power to move us in the direction we want to go. But at the end of the day, you have to recognize things are out of our control. We can't control everything. And I think that that was probably what was frustrating for Dave, because while he is a person of faith, he wasn't in quite the same place. And I think that's true for men in general. They tend to be more, I have to take care of everything, you know, and I'm going to make it all happen. And to just be able to say, you know, honey, it's going to be okay. It's going to be, I can't tell you how many conversations we had like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, just
this is important.
Pushing just through, kind of having pushing through. And it was hard. We had just bought a house, you know, we had a daughter. No. I was crazy. And then you have employees who you care about, you know, and you, so it was,
challenging to say the least.
I don't recommend it to anyone, but you know, in the end, that's, I think, the nature of business. And since then, you know, we've been through a variety of smaller challenges. I think that was our biggest challenge. But, you know, in fact, this is kind of funny. I was chatting with somebody this morning that, I mean, this competitor that I worked with is, you know, a fierce competitor.
Yeah.
And the competition and some of the things that happened was so brutal that the LA Times and our local paper both did stories, and the headlines on the LA Times was front page. Was whale wars.
Oh, goodness.
That's how fierce the competition was.
Yeah.
And brutal and a bit bloody. And so, you know, to be able to come around now and see the LA Times today doing this great story and about the two companies working together in what is not just a pretend, hey, we're friends, but we've really been able to address some of the issues and to really recognize that, you know, rising tides raises all boats.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's the bigger picture. And that by doing things together, it's very powerful. It's very, very powerful. So again, you know, I think that
I like that analogy. I really like the analogy when you said the rising tides bring, you know, elevate both boats, right? Or multiple boats. And I wanted to kind of, you know, in just a little bit, I want to kind of bring Shawnee on to talk about friendly competition and what it means to deal with obstacles and a little bit of that fear of not knowing what's going to happen. But just for a little bit more, Giselle, I do want to ask you to maybe expand a little bit more about, I know that when I have, you know, entrepreneurs who are successful and have had a number of years on, you know, and have them come on the show, they usually when they look back to their early days, you know, they usually kind of look back with, you know, there's a couple of things usually that stands out to them that they go, you know what, thank goodness I did X, Y, Z and not whatever, right? And usually there's a few things that stood out to them, whether that's, you know, focusing on family or maybe focusing on one specific aspect of their business rather than multiples, right? I'm kind of curious because obviously I'm not, you know, in the space of whale watching and I'm always fascinated by that world. But what did you think were some of the 2 to 3 maybe key ingredients in scaling and helping your mission to get this, you know, this world in front of everyone else? What were some of those key things in the early days that now looking back after a few years already, several years into your career now that you can go, you know what, that's a good thing that we did. I mean, aside from some of the things that you've already touched on.
I think there are several things that come to mind, but there's a common thread through all of them. As entrepreneurs, that I think is very important. And my husband is, he's the poster child for this. And you can ask anyone who knows him. And I'm not quite that person. I'm more, you know, so here's what it is. He never takes no for an answer. He doesn't take no for an answer. He will not take no for an answer. So he fixes his eyes on something and other people hear no and they fall away. And he keeps pushing. No, I'm going to turn you into yes. And I could give you multiple examples. One of them that comes to mind that I love this story is we had bought a sailboat, a sailing catamaran. And because at one point in the process, 3 o'clock in the morning, Dave wakes me up and he goes, I just had this great idea. Oh, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. What is it? And he says, I want to build a boat that's like Disneyland at sea. And people could be like down underneath the water surface and they could look out and see dolphins swimming alongside them. And they would love that, you know. That's a great idea, honey. Yeah. Okay. So when we start looking for a boat, it means that we want to find a boat that has enough of a draft, enough boat underwater to where we could build a space. It's not going to be a big space, but a space where people can go and have this eye to eye experience with these animals, because it's life changing when you have this connection with the animals. So we find the boat. We get the architect, the marine architect, to drop the plans. He goes to the Coast Guard because they have to approve it. And they say, no. He goes back to the architect. The architect says, look, it's sound. There's nothing wrong with it. It's bulletproof glass. It's actually stronger than the hull. So he does a couple of things. We find the boat builder. We talk to him. We redo the plans. He goes back to the Coast Guard. They say no. He says, okay. This is the Long Beach Coast Guard. He says, okay, I'm going to Washington. So he goes to Washington.
Wow.
And Washington says, maybe if you can get Long Beach to say yes. Ah. So he's like, okay, that's something. So he goes back.
Yeah.
And now what he does, and he says, okay, explain to me your reasons. So they give him reasons. Safety. It's an area meant for crew, not for passengers. It's like, okay. So he says, if I can prove to you that it's safe for passengers, will you consider it? Sure. So he shoots this video down in the hull of the boat, and he's talking to them and he's explaining to them why it's safe and why, you know, passengers aren't going to get knocked around when they're out at sea. And then he comes up out of the area that he was discussing, putting the pods in, we call them pods. And when what you realize is that the whole time he was talking and on film, he was actually out on the ocean, in the open ocean, and it was pretty rough. Mm. And he was as stable as could be. So he demonstrated to them, it's not what you think. It's not going to be this, you know, passengers getting thrown around. And then he said, I want to come in. I want to show you something that I did. So he brought it in and he showed it to them while he was sitting there with them. And they were like, oh, okay. Well, maybe. Yeah, you know what? Maybe we'll do that. And so they gave us permission to do it if Washington would sign off on it. So everyone wants to cover their like, behind, you know, their
like
butts.
Pointing so at each other, yeah.
Yeah. So he gets Washington to sign off, Long Beach signs off, and we get the first one put in. And then after 2 years, you know, I mean, the first time I got in there and it was just incredible. I said, okay, well, you know what we've got to do? We've got to put one on the other side.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah. So then we get the second one put in, and we're still the only boat in the world that I know of that has the underwater viewing pods, and people love it. You know, they absolutely love it. So, so that's one example of, he just doesn't take no for an answer. And he's done this again and again with different boats that he wanted to innovate. And, you know, we have another catamaran he did something similar with, and just again and again. And, you know, we laugh and we say, oh, you know, the Coast Guard, you know, that when they see him coming, they're like, no.
Yeah. But I love that what he did, like he went, you know, he went over, you know, over someone to the authority, and then the authority go, no, go back. And then you circle back.
Yeah.
Process, yep. Right.
Exactly. And he's done that in other areas where we've had, you know, the California Coastal Commission or the County of Orange, attorneys telling us you can't do a thing. And Dave is like, okay, you know, I don't want to break the law. Show me the law. And he will sit down and read all 240 pages of it and then come back to them and say, I don't know if you're familiar with the law because this is what it says. And he'll just send them pages and pages and pages of stuff. And they're like, oh, and you find out, you know, that the council that
it's actually permissible.
To know it is permissible. And in fact, we're not just prohibited, we're protected.
Right.
So, you know, just my advice to any entrepreneur is, and this is one of the things we train into some of our managers, is you don't take no for an answer. You know, you push forward like everything depends on this. Mm-hmm. And of course you do it respectfully, you do it within the law, but you know, you just don't take no for an answer. So if there's anybody listening to this right now and they've been told no, and they're really discouraged and they just want to crawl in bed and pull the sheets up over their head and say, you know, you know, just stop it. Right. Don't.
Yeah.
Figure it out. Yeah. Come back, because the people that don't take no for an answer are the ones who are going to be around tomorrow and, you know, who will be your superstars in a year.
This is,
you know,
this is so important, because I think it is, I think when people say no, there are actually different layers of no, maybe not in that way, right? Not in that way,
right.
Or not now, or not this particularly, right? Or whatever.
Right. Or no, I don't like you. Or no, just, I don't like you. And I'm going to use my position to, you know, make your life uncomfortable or miserable or whatever.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, someone like me who's on the more, you know, I want people to like me. And so I get sad, you know, when people say no, but I've learned from my husband that, you know, you just push on and, you know, especially when you believe in what you're doing.
Yeah. And this is so important, like pushing on in a way that is, you know, with your conviction, what you believe that you can do and whatever it is that you're doing can do for other people as well, which kind of leads me actually. And I want to bring Shawnee on here to weigh in on, because Shawnee, you know, obviously in the bio, we've mentioned that you're a 2-time Olympian and you train for, you know, you help Canada basketball teams to go to the Olympics and all these amazing accomplishments. And I want to kind of ask you, when perhaps you have an example of, you know, when you work with you know, an athlete and you see something similar to what Giselle was describing in Dave, you know, when they kind of are so determined that maybe they're too tired or whatever, but they still push on. Were there examples that jumped to mind, Shawnee, in your you know, years that you've been coaching?
A phrase that I like to use is mental toughness. And, you know, we can say that that's a sport term, but I think it's a life term. You know, when I was listening to Giselle's story, I'm just thinking, yeah, that's a mental toughness story. That's a mental toughness example. And, you know, what I find is my experience with athletes is, it's like so many things in life. Talent will take you so far, but then there's something else. Like, what is this something else? And I worked with many talented athletes that underperform, and I've worked with many less talented athletes that overperform. So what is it? What's that differentiator? And there's
Shawnee.
Well, there's something in there that we have. I call it mental toughness. You could call it grit. You could call it resilience. You can call it persistence. All of those are qualities of mental toughness. And I really believe it's the difference between good and great. Mm. And it's the difference between great and greater. And greatest, because at some point, talent isn't going to get you to the top of the podium.
Yeah.
And when I'm working with athletes, I don't just talk about the sport podium. I talk about the podium of life. And there's something about this ability to persist and solve a problem. Like when I was listening to, you know, Giselle's stories, you say, well, I'm not going to take no for an answer. But you flip that and say, well, then what are you doing? You're solving a problem. You're solving a problem. You're solving a problem. You're solving a problem. And every problem in our life, in our sport, has been solved by someone. And I think that's quite liberating, whether you're an athlete, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're a parent. Somebody out there has had the exact same problem that I'm having right now, and they figured out a solution. That means that I can figure out a solution. So mental toughness is not just reserved for the elite. Everybody can have mental toughness. You're not born with it. It's a skill, and skills can be trained, learned, and sharpened.
Yeah. And I love this kind of highlighting on there are two different ways that you can take talent, right? I mean, let's just say that Dave had all this amazing filmmaking talent, but he didn't really use it for and harbor it and grow it right into this kind of amazing way to then feed his mission. And similar to what your example that you were sharing, Shawnee, is that you can be talented, but then only go so far. And on the flip side, you can be not so talented, but you can work on it so hard and so far in such a meaningful way that it takes you even further, you know? And so mental toughness is kind of interesting. And I want to kind of zoom in for a minute, Shawnee, if that's okay with you, perhaps. And I know that with coaches, you know, when they're out, you know, on the court and in the field, perhaps they, you know, their team members are starting to get tired, exhausted, right? And just kind of speaking about mental toughness, what are some things that you usually talk to or talk about, you know, some words that you usually share with your team members, right, your athletes, that will then usually help them kind of bounce back to being, you know what, I can do this. This is something that I'll do. What are some of those things that you usually use to shift their mindset?
Well, my favorite word is tolerate. And when athletes come to me and when parents come to me on behalf of their athletes or coaches come to me on behalf of their athletes, when I dig down to what they want me to do, they want me to be a magician where I can wave my magic wand or I can give them a prescription for a pill to take away all of their problems. And I'm like, don't hire me for that, because that's not what mental toughness is. Mental toughness is not removing obstacles so the path becomes easier. Mental toughness is saying obstacles are part of life. They're part of sport. They're part of relationships. They're part of business. Let me get a toolkit to manage the obstacles. And what I teach the athletes, coaches, and parents that I work with is mental toughness is the ability to tolerate discomfort, physical discomfort, and emotional discomfort. That is not what we teach. Sport in general is really good at teaching us to tolerate physical discomfort, get fitter, get stronger, run more lines, do more laps, lift more weights. Mm-hmm. But what about the emotional discomfort? And so I work with them on tolerating the discomfort of obstacles, tolerating the discomfort of negative feelings, tolerating the discomfort of failures and setbacks and mistakes. Because when you tolerate discomfort, I didn't say you had to like it. Tolerating does not mean liking it.
Yeah.
It means tolerating it. And this is the thing that I love so much about this mental toughness. Remember, I said it's a skill that we can get better at. When you practice tolerating, your tolerance grows. Mental toughness is like a muscle. The more you work at it, the bigger it grows.
Well, and
our tolerance grows.
I absolutely love that highlighting that you had mentioned on, you know, it's, you can increase the tolerance, right? And it's like a muscle almost. And you can keep pushing it. And I think the similar to how Dave, for instance, went from just an idea to Washington to finally making it a fruition, I think this is fantastic. And you can probably see this definitely in athletes as well, where there are many athletes, I think, in the world where they've become these amazing top athletes. And years before that, though, you've never heard of them, right? And it's just kind of like, I think it does take some time. And your highlighting of mental toughness, I think, is really, really important. Now, on the flip side, though, because we've touched on with Giselle, we've touched on how, you know, they were for 6 months, they were struggling. Not so much struggling, but it wasn't like the most fun moment, right? But they kind of pushed through. Can you kind of, Shawnee, can you kind of weigh in on maybe when a time when you have seen, you know, kind of people give in to not wanting to push and kind of up level their tolerance to mental toughness and whether, you know, whether they've ever bounced back and what are some of the repercussions of not bouncing back? For instance, maybe they said, coach, you know what, I'm not going to do it. And then they didn't, or maybe they didn't say that, but they thought it, and you can kind of see it in them. But then they came back and they're like, you know what, never mind, I'll do it. Like, were there moments of switchback like that in your years of coaching?
I was having a conversation just a couple days ago with an athlete, and the context that became so clear to me is that sport has sold us something that, in my opinion, is not true. And life has kind of done the same thing. If you want it badly enough, you can have anything as long as you want it badly enough. Mm-hmm. You can have anything as long as you work hard enough. I'm like, I don't believe that. Because what I see is these athletes, parents, and coaches as well. Remember, this isn't just athletes. Like, parents and coaches are striving for the same things that their kids and athletes are. Is that, I was having this conversation. This athlete's been really working hard, lots of extra time in the gym, and the goal is to get a Div 1 scholarship. And I said, well, what makes you think that your hard work guarantees you're going to get a Div 1 scholarship? I said, who sold you that bill of goods?
Yeah.
And the reason I bring that up is because where I see athletes give up is they think that, or parents and coaches, if I work really hard for this period of time, it earns me the right to have X. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, whoa.
Nope.
Last time I checked, there are no guarantees. And so they work for a period of time. And then when they don't get X, they give up, or they give in, or they shut down. And what I help them see is that, you know, sport is a gamble. Because if working hard was the only thing you had to do to get what you wanted, wouldn't that just be wonderful?
Yeah.
That's not how life works. Look at Dave.
Yeah.
I mean, go back to this story of Dave.
Yeah.
Dave worked hard from the very first get-go. And if his first no, he'd be like, oh man, that's not fair. I worked hard and somebody told me no. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
But this is what we get sold, that if we just work hard, if we just want it enough, there's a guarantee waiting for us. So the athletes that I see giving up, I get them to flip their perspective and say, are you willing to jump in on this gamble called sport? Because ideally, what I want them to do is get to the top of the podium of life. And we know that it's the process that matters. Because when we have grit and perseverance, persistence, mental toughness, all of these things, the ability to tolerate discomfort, what are we really doing? We're growing our character.
Yeah.
We're growing ourselves. We're gaining life skills that get us to the top of the podium. That does not guarantee a Div 1 scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
But the character you build becomes yours forever. So I get them to flip the switch and say, will you come into this journey with me and I'll help you along? But there's no guarantee at the end, but the process is going to change you forever.
Yeah. And I think it's almost that finding that passion for the process, right? If you can enjoy the process, it does almost doesn't matter what the result is. Sure, it'd be nice if you get Div 1, if you win gold medals and the Olympics and all these other things. But if you can enjoy the process and you find a process that you can enjoy, then that's just for you and no one can take that, which kind of reminded me. I think it's great that you kind of pointed, Shauna, you pointed Dave's experience back out, because Giselle, I'm curious to hear about, you know, because in your work, it's not just about, I guess, the boats and all of the things that you're doing, right? The business side of it, but it's also about the whales, the dolphins. Do you guys develop almost like an affinity to each, because I know some maybe animal trainers, for instance, who know their animals, like they have right. names for them. Does that happen with you guys? Is that how you kind of find almost that passion for the process, like Shawnee had mentioned?
I think it's, there are individuals. In fact, just yesterday we were compiling a list of the different individual dolphins or humpback whales or blue whales that we see. And I think we have, I don't know, 20, 25 different individuals that, you know, are seen on a recurring basis over the years, right? So, you know, we love that. We love seeing them because it brings so much hope. They're still around. I think for us, it's broader. And so we're looking, when we're on the water, we experience, it's breathtaking. So if you've never been out there with a pod of dolphin, and this is my favorite thing to describe besides the blue whale behind me, which is my other favorite thing to yeah. describe. But there's two things. And one of them is when you're out there and, you know, you see a pod of dolphin, and we see megapods here. So we see pods as big as 5 or 10,000. Our average size pod is several hundred. And they're out there. I was just out there before this crummy weather hit. And I was out there a week ago with some folks who had not ever been out of Dana Point. And we got super blessed because there was a pod of Pacific white-sided dolphin visiting the area. And then we got into a megapod of common dolphin. And this megapod stretched for miles. And it was the coolest thing. But as you're moving towards the dolphin and they're doing their thing and they see the boat coming, for them, that says fun. And so they turn and individuals start to come through the water towards you. And as they're racing towards you, you know, it's like they saw a playground, like kids, you know, oh, playground, here we go, yeah. you know, and off they go. It's like that. And they start coming and, you know, Dave will say, where else in nature can you go and experience wild animals racing towards you, not to eat you, and not to, you know, not to be fed, but to play, to interact. And so they come. It's my favorite moment when I see them choosing to come to the boat, and they'll race along the side. They love to bow ride, and they race along, and they'll flip, and they'll do all kinds of fun things. But the favorite thing I love is when they will turn and look up at you. And, or if you're in the pods, they'll just swim along the pod. And they'll, you know, they're checking you out. They're checking you out. And adorable. So I might not know that individual's name, but I know that dolphin species. Yeah. And I know that that's what they love to do. And I see the babies and I see, you know, I can see the females or the males, and you just feel such a connection. Our tagline is experience the connection, because I think when people have this connection with nature, with the animals, it's life-changing. When you hear a blue whale, like the one behind me, exhale, they exhale at 220, 240 miles an hour. And it's just this sound like nothing else you've ever heard. You can't mistake it for anything. It's just this incredible sound. And the blow goes 40 feet in the air. And you're thinking, this is so big. This is so much bigger than me. You know, this is bigger than the boat. This is way bigger than anything I've ever seen. It's the biggest animal on the planet that's ever been on the planet. Yeah. It's life-changing. So I think for us, the passion is really wanting people to experience this connection and to have that, you know, have that, that experience so that they can take it home. And, you know, it fuels them for those obstacles that come.
Yeah. And I agree with what you're saying there, Giselle, in that kind of those, just even just a few seconds of that experience was just enough for all the years that you work and hard, you know, just toil and labor and everything. And just those moments of, oh, this is why I wake up in the morning, right? Like, I think for different people, yeah, that's different. Yeah. Like for some folks, it's their kids, you know, it's the vacation perhaps or whatever.
I'm sorry, Shawnee, I'm writing notes on what you're saying because it's so good. I think it's so, and it's so applicable to every area of life. So I'm just excited that I'm on the call with you. That, you know, expectation is huge. And I think that you nailed it when you were talking, Shawnee, about how, you know, you're working with an athlete and well, my expectation is if I do A and B, I'll get C. And we experience that with our customers all the time. If I come out on a trip, I will get dolphins performing and whales, you know, blowing. Well, this is the wild,
yeah,
people, you know, it's not a marine park and they do what they want to do. And the people who come and have these life-changing experiences are the ones who come and they're just happy to be out on the water. And anything else is frosting on the cake for them. And so they're just so grateful. And we get letters from people who are like, oh my gosh, you know, this was incredible. I'd never seen this before. I had never been on the ocean before. I'd never been on a boat. And they're just grateful. So they have this mindset that's really appreciative. And then we get other people. We'll show them blue whales. And they'll say, well, I was looking for dolphins and I'm not happy. And I, you know, I want a refund.
Wow.
And I'm like, are you really? Or, you know, they'll see a megapod of dolphin, but they're upset because, you know, they didn't see a whale.
Yeah.
It's all about expectations. And so I love what you said about how there's no guarantee that hard work will, you know, give you the achievements you want. The goal is to develop, you know, character along the way. I think I'm quoting you correctly. Yeah. And it's a powerful thing. And the goal is to appreciate what we have when we're out there or what we have, even when we're going to the grocery store, you know, you can bring it right down to the mundane things that we have to do on a daily basis. Whenever I go to Costco or Trader Joe's, you know, I'm like, how are you doing today? I'm great. I'm at a Costco. Look at me. You know, I'm not in some third world country. If you've ever been to one and you can't even find a food, there's no stores, you know, you can't get anything. I am blessed to be here. And so gratitude, I think, is an important component of getting you over some of those obstacles that life is going to give you. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I'm kind of reminded because Shawnee, you touched earlier on, you know, people wanting to get to Div 1, or they are, you know, maybe wanting just the cool parts, you know, like the parts that are, you know, really, really appealing. And then the middle parts, they're not as interested. So I'm kind of curious because you've been a 2-time Olympian, you know, you're assistant coach for the Canadian basketball team. And I'm kind of curious, I'm sure you've trained, you know, and you've coached a lot of the athletes in a fantastic way. But do you recall any moments perhaps in the journey towards the Olympics or maybe during the Olympics when one or two perhaps, and you don't have to mention any names of one or two players perhaps just couldn't get themselves to, you know, to perform the way that they want it perhaps. And what are some things that perhaps help them get out of that obstacle? And I think it'd be useful for the audience to kind of hear if there is anything that people can do to kind of shift that perspective again, like you've already mentioned.
Such a great question. And you know what I love about it is sport teaches us not to talk about when things aren't going well. I mean, look at social media. In my opinion, it is the biggest fluff show in the world. And fluff is the opposite of substance. And you look at social media and every athlete is rocking it. Here's my highlight video. Here's me and my friends celebrating. Here's me working out. Here's me whatever. And I'm like, okay, great. But I know sport, just like life, a lot of times it's 50-50. 50% happy, 50% crappy. So why are we not, where's the crappy? Like, we have to talk about the poop.
Yeah.
And sport teaches us not to do that. Mm-hmm. Sport teaches us never show weakness, never let them see you sweat, pound your chest and tell the world how great you are and how great your life is and how well you're doing. Well, if you look at what happens in sport, there's only one winner. There's only one winner. Yeah. There only one team wins the game. Only one athlete wins the competition. Only one athlete wins an Olympic gold medal. So what about the other 99.9% of the people that are dealing with the poopy? How can we never hear those stories? So yeah. The reason that I think your question is so important is I've gotten to experience firsthand what happens when you are in the middle of a complete and absolute disappointment. And what I learned from it, and that's why I decided to invest in mental toughness for athletes, coaches, and parents, is you cannot prepare for the storm in the storm. It is too late.
Yeah.
You have to prepare for the storm before the storm. But sport doesn't mm-hmm. teach that. Sport teaches just pretend the storm isn't coming. We're the greatest. We're the best. Let's put something on social media. And then the storm happens. And then you get to see, you know, we say sport builds character, and I agree with that, but I also think sport reveals it. If you ever want your character to get revealed, watch how you handle disappointment.
Mm.
Watch what happens when you're in the middle of the championship game and you're the favorite and you're down six with 2 minutes to go. Then you're going to find out whether you prepared for the storm. And if you didn't, if you think the coach calling a timeout in the middle of the storm and teaching you how to row the lifeboats, how to put your life jacket on and give you swimming lessons with 2 minutes to go, way too late. So when I work with athletes, parents, and coaches, we deal with the storm before the storm. And then I tell them, the storm is going to come, put your life jacket on and start swimming, because you know how to swim. You know how to put your life jacket on because we practiced it. We worked on it. We talked about it. You know, I work with some LPGA golfers, and you want to talk about storms and the whole freaking world is watching.
Yeah.
And they're watching you sweat, even though you're pretending that you're not sweating. They're watching you stand over a 3-foot putt. You know, we call it the puke zone because you want to puke. But if you haven't practiced dealing with those feelings before the feelings hit, what's going to happen? So I've been, you know, I've been in sport my whole life, you know, at the grassroots level and at the Olympic level, and I've experienced, you know, the highest highs and the lowest lows. I mean, there's a wonderful, back in the day that I used to watch when I was in elementary school, The Wide World of Sports, with that skier that crashes, and they talk about the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. I don't think we talk enough about the agony of defeat. And so we do. And we get real, and I help athletes deal with a storm that sport and life always brings.
Yeah, this is fantastic, because what I think is so important, and even Giselle touched on this as well, which is great, is, you know, there is, whether it's disappointment, right, and defeat, whatever spectrum of just kind of down that is, and whether that's before you go on to the actual game, or before you actually become a successful business or whatever it is, or after, right, even when you're at a high, there's still quite a ways that you can fall, right? And that what you were saying about the defeat. And I want to ask you, Shawnee, if you can please expand a little bit upon just kind of how you have helped, you know, obviously, and coached the athletes and maybe even the parents as well, to deal with some of those disappointments, whether that's, you know, before the game, right, and just kind of having that mental toughness before, and even if they don't have a good day when they're training or whatever, or when they're already at, you know, showtime, and when it's really everyone's watching and they failed. 99% of that, you were saying, you know, the majority of people failed. What do you talk about when you, you know, in the locker room or in post, you know, when you guys are reviewing some of those, you know, perhaps games that perhaps you guys didn't win, you know?
Well, number one, winning and losing is out of our control because it's an outcome. And if winning and losing was in our control, how easy sport would be. So if we understand that it's out of our control, for me, it's then about, did I show up today as the best version of myself? And sport talks a lot about, are you playing to win or are you playing not to lose? Like, think about the difference of those two things, because when you're playing not to lose and you lose, it's really tough. Because you know you choked.
Yeah.
You know you, and you also know you hid. And fear took over. And you did not know what to do with it. When you play to win, you understand winning isn't guaranteed, but now you play with courage, because the fear of losing doesn't hold you back. Because you know you can't control it. And there are times where you get beat by a better team. You get beat by a better competitor. You get beat because someone else had a better offense than you did. There are so many reasons. So I work with athletes, parents, and coaches. It is much easier to get over disappointment when you know you showed up as the best version of yourself. You played courageously. You played to win. You took some risks. You just put it out on the table. And on that day, it wasn't enough to win. And that is okay. You can live with that. There's a difference between being disappointed and devastated. When you've played courageously, I believe you're disappointed. When you choke, I believe you're devastated.
Yeah. And this is such an important reframe, right, Shauna? And I want to kind of point this out for a minute for the audience who's listening, who have, you know, who's maybe perhaps dealing with this and they are at a low and they're just kind of like, well, is this disappointment? Is this choking? Right. And there is a difference. And I'm so glad that you pointed that out because it's not really, you know, immediately obvious. And I think a lot of people think it's outside of, you know, this reframe is outside of their control, that you can kind of look at things from your perspective and the outcome, whether you win or lose or whatever that is still within, you know, your control and how you kind of bounce back and what that means to you is within your control. So I do like that a lot, which I really hugely appreciate. Now, I am kind of curious because you had mentioned your work with LPGA golfers, right? And obviously with your work in basketball as well. Two very different, I don't want to say industries, but two very different ways of playing a game. And they're obviously two different games, but one is, I mean, you know, the golf, it has the reputation of everybody has to be quiet, right? Everybody has to be quiet and everybody has to kind of silence their phone, not a pin drop, you know, nothing. And, you know, basketball obviously is a little bit more dynamic, you know, everyone's participating in the audience, everybody's participating. And I think I want to kind of draw parallels to people who are working, right? And they're perhaps working in their career, business, whatever it is that they're doing. And they are thinking that the way certain things that they do have to be done a certain way, right? Like maybe they're working from home and they go, you know what? I have to do this way. It has to be, you know, and you mentioned even social media because other people are doing social media. I have to also do. So I wanted to touch on, you know, particularly with the LPGA, when perhaps you've seen moments when, you know, the crowd wasn't as quiet as they should be, and perhaps that disturbs focus, right? And what is kind of the mindset reframe that you can share with the audience who's listening as far as, you know what, it, again, it's not within our control, and what should they do about things that are, you know, unexpected things that kind of come up that disturbs their flow, their process, their work, and definitely their result.
The way that I hear your question is, what are we all seeking? We're seeking comfort, right? So when things go the way we want it to go, when we get a whole bunch of likes on our social media, when we sell a new product, when we win a game, when we're, so we desire comfort. We're looking for comfort. And I'm a fan of comfort. Like, I'll raise my hand for that. I'm like, yeah, pick me. But I also understand that discomfort. Remember I said happy and crappy. We have to deal with both. And you know, when I think of myself as a small business owner, and I think about it with my athletes, and I really try to work on the same skills that I'm teaching them, because comfort says, if I feel comfortable, then I feel confident. And when I feel confident, I can make the putt. When I feel confident, I can launch a new product. And what I teach is, I mean, parents who sign their kids up, they're like, Shauna, the number one thing that I want you to teach my child is confidence. I'm like, don't hire me for that. Because my opinion, confidence is an emotion based on results. I'll say that again. Confidence is an emotion based on results. That's what comfort is. It's an emotion. Confidence is an emotion. Well, I'm a real fan of Brené Brown, and I've taken one of her concepts and I teach it to myself because I need this as a small business owner, and I teach it to the athletes, parents, and coaches. I say, we're not going to talk about confidence because it comes and goes. If you're not good at something, you shouldn't feel confident, and I can't help you with that. If you're crappy, I cannot help you feel confident, because competence and confidence are connected. So how about, instead of confidence, how about courage? Because Brené Brown says you can be brave and afraid at the same time.
Yeah.
I think that is the most liberating. Nobody ever taught me that as an athlete. No one ever taught me that when I was a career coach. And I was afraid all of the time, insecure all of the time, and tried not to be. But if you think about it, like fear, lack of confidence, those are emotions. And brave is an action. That means those two things can exist simultaneously.
Yep.
I can feel uncertain and still take a brave action. That has helped me so much in my business. That helps me so much coaching athletes, parents, and coaches, because we're all searching for this feeling of comfort. And I'm like, great, but what are we going to do when the discomfort is there? Well, let's try brave and afraid at the same time. That has changed my mindset in my business, and it changes how I coach my clients.
Yeah, this is so true. And it's so important to kind of have that separation, right? And to kind of think of it from the perspective of courage, because as long as you have the courage, and courage, I think I agree with Brené on this, and definitely with a lot, I think it's people are becoming much more aware of this, you know, and that it doesn't mean it's the lack of fear. It just means that it's, you know, you're willing to go through what's put in front of you. I think it's important. Now, Shawnee, believe it or not, we are out of time. So it's been a terrific conversation with you and Giselle, and it's so great. And I will share links to each of them so that you guys who are listening can check them out. Fantastic work, obviously, that they're doing in their own way. And I always encourage everyone listening to adopt and adapt and emulate and make it your own. And the goal to obviously bring various different perspectives into this podcast is to for sure to have the audience listen, and you guys who are listening in to really take home at least even just one thing that you guys can then improve and adapt as I mentioned for your own business and your own career and obviously life, as Shawnee had mentioned. So for that reason, thank you, Shawnee. Thank you, Giselle, and we'll see you guys next time. Be sure to hit follow, subscribe, add, or collect, and let's dive in.